You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Reema Patel. I'm the programme manager for the RSA Citizens Economic Council, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here this afternoon. Some of you may remember that we launched the RSA Citizens Economic Council in the immediate aftermath of the EU referendum. We convene again immediately after another momentous occasion, the election of Donald Trump in the USA. Yet again, we find ourselves faced with more questions than answers, more uncertainties than certainty, and more walls than bridges. It is times like these that demonstrate the importance of places like the RSA, the people we bring together, and the dialogues that we have. It is also times like these that demonstrate the importance of the work that we do. One example, but by no means the only example, is the RSA Citizens Economic Council. We are bringing together a diverse group of 60 citizens to learn about, to deliberate on, and to influence national economic policy over a period of several months. And we aim to demonstrate that we can do much better with our democracy and our economy, not just in the UK, but also across the world. Embedded within the question we are asking today, economics for everyone, what needs to change, is a statement. Now, more than ever, we realise that things need to change if our democracy and economy is to serve everyone and bring us together to explore common interests and common value. I'm delighted to welcome our fantastic, diverse panel today on this very timely occasion to explore what that looks like. I'll introduce them, if I may. To my right is Katie Gersh. She's the Chief Executive of the Electoral Reform Society, and also Julia Ramplin. She's the editor of The Staggers, which is a New Statesman's online political blog. To my left is Claire Payne. She's the Economic Justice Programme Manager at the Barrow Cadbury Trust, and also Joe Earle. He is a trustee of Economy. He also campaigns for rethinking economics and is the author of a book called The Econocracy, which is launched, and I thoroughly recommend that you take a look at it. So without any further ado, I'm going to invite Katie to say a few words in response to our question.
Great, thank you very much. It's fantastic to be here. Thank you very much to Reema and the RSA, and what timing you have. A very good and interesting time to be having this discussion. The Electoral Reform Society is a campaigning organisation. We campaign for a better democracy in the UK, and our vision is of a highly participative democracy where its participation isn't casting a vote once every 5 years. It's about a really kind of fulsome citizenry and citizenship, and there's all kinds of things we could do to make that happen. I'm really excited about the economics panel because I think we need more and more concrete examples of a more deliberative approach where people can get together, challenge their views, become more knowledgeable. So I think it's really exciting. Of course, it's timely because there is a conversation going on, isn't there, right now, in the light of the EU referendum, in the light of the American election result, about the relationship between economic policy, economic investment, economic power, people's experiences and their economic wealth or lack of it, and their electoral participation. And I don't think any of us have got all the answers on that, but some people are saying, for example, well, you know, people in an economically deprived area will be even more driven to go out and take part in a vote when maybe they're normally don't vote at all, or they will vote in a particular way, perhaps if they feel that that is their only outlet. So that is a rich conversation, I think, that's going on and to be had. Does our democracy work at the moment? Does it really allow people to get to grips with economics and allow people, and not just elected representatives, to think about, digest and make economic decisions? No. We're still rather stuck in this old style ideal of a representative democracy where you give somebody a mandate. You go to the ballot box, you give them a mandate, they're the experts, they go off and they do all the decision making. It doesn't work anymore. Look at what happened. We added on a direct democracy tool, didn't we, with the Brexit vote, so which was a perfectly valid, legitimate thing to do. Referendums can have a place. They can be done well. They can also be done terribly badly. We did that. Did any of us, did we really think as a society about what that meant for the aftermath of making decisions and public involvement in the economic decisions that are now going to be made about Brexit? It feels as though a referendum was held and now there are really big questions about where legitimacy lies in terms of the decisions that are now going to be made. So that's it's a really big deal, I think. There's not a clear path, I don't think, to the question of what is the public involvement in the negotiations around Brexit. It seems as though there was a very clear, decisive result and decision, by the way, so I'm not questioning that at all. But it seems to me that we need to know from each other what are the kind of principles of negotiation that would form trade policy, for example. That's absolutely something that the public need to be part of. And what is the route map going to be there? There's some really big challenges facing our democracy. The two-party system was set up for another era. We live and breathe and are part of a multi-party politics where we all want to vote for a much larger range of parties than ever before. There's a lot of disenchantment with the way that we do politics. We see that in levels of trust. We see that in turnout. There's all kinds of measures out there. And we've not really got to grips with, in any way other than a very piecemeal fashion, the relationships between and within the nations of the UK. And how can we really sort out the economy if we've not squared that? We're becoming more federal, which I think a lot of people, and I really support the decentralisation and devolution of power, but we're doing it, we're not doing it in a kind of a thought through way, and we're very often not involving the public. Just look at the English devolution decisions, which are all about economics. I mean, they're about lots of things, but they're about power, they're about fiscal power, they're about how much power and control you have over an investment in your local area. The public so far have been completely cut out of that debate. It's been very much behind closed doors, so there are huge issues there. And then, of course, when we look squarely at economics and economic decisions, these things are so global now. Is it any surprise that people rationally question the ability of domestic politicians to have the economic control and power and influence that they're used to, and that will really affect people's trust in politics as well? So I suppose what I'm saying is there are this close connection between economics and politics and what is the rich role for citizens in that, and it feels as though we're really scrabbling to do the democratic kind of reawakening and get our democracy in a good position to be able to do that. Just a couple of other things to say. What would make, and I was asked to sort of say, what do we need to change? What would make a difference? I think we need a much more deliberative democracy. Look at the Scottish referendum debate, where people had 2 years. They had the time and the space to take on the agenda and the issues for themselves. And no matter what side you were on, or if you didn't have a side in that debate, there was a richness and a breadth to the discussions that people had. And citizens got to grips with the minutiae of things like the currency under independence, currency economics, what that would look like. We didn't have that with the EU referendum. Surprise, surprise, if you only give people 4 months to get to grips with a whole load of really complex issues, and it's mainly about being shouted at by two campaigns instead of having really great discussions as citizens, that didn't happen. So we did a much more deliberative democracy. There's a stack of examples out there how to do it. We were involved with citizens' assemblies, randomly selected citizens can be a great way to do that. The Citizens Economics Panel, Brazil, participatory budgeting. We're beginning to test some of that stuff here. The question is how you test it, how you scale it, so that people can really be in charge of and be much more involved with the economic decisions that they should be, and not leaving it old style to the mandate and the expertise of the elected representatives. Thank you.
Thank you. Julie? I'm going to talk. I am the editor of the politics blog at the New Statesman, but before that I was a financial journalist for a few years, and then I became the one of the editors of the online money section at the Mirror. So I'm going to draw a little bit more on that when I talk about communicating economics to a very general public, and especially when you can see exactly how many people are reading what you've written. So the thing about economics is that the impact of bad economic policy is often invisible, and then suddenly it comes out of nowhere and displays itself in very stark terms. And I think that yesterday's electoral result is a great example of that, and suddenly we're looking at you know, deindustrialized towns in America that actually we've just ignored for 20 or 30 years. But I just wanted to start with some other examples of when in my life I've seen something that I didn't really care about when I was a teenager present itself and make me interested in economics. So the first time was when I was at university during the financial crisis. And my friends at university were studying economics, and they would still talk to me about these things that were actually no different to what they studied in 2005 or 2001. And it was a very pseudo-scientific, I'm going to say, version of liberal economics that had no room for what was adjustment for what was actually happening in front of our eyes or what we were hearing on the radio. And it was only when I went home for Christmas and I tried to find a holiday job that I'm from Edinburgh, which is a city that has historically had a huge banking industry, and I found I couldn't get anyone to take my CV, that I could see the impact of this impending crisis on my entire city and its infrastructure. And again, when I moved to London, that was the time of the Occupy movement outside St. Paul's. By this time, the financial crisis, the effects had been felt for a few years, but it was only when people started camping in the cold winter nights outside a symbol of London that you wake up and think, wow, something has happened here. So now that we've had the two electoral surprises of Brexit and the US election, I think it's a time that we're starting to look not only at the short-term impact of the financial crisis, but also at the longer-term impact of decisions that were made in the 80s, for example, about industry and towns, or going back even further to when Britain started to lose momentum in industrialisation. But, I mean, these have been visible for some time if you went to certain northeastern towns, but the thing is, we didn't. The journalists didn't. The economists didn't, the policymakers didn't, and the politicians didn't. So unless you see it in front of your eyes, it's very easy to forget about it. And I think that that applies both to people who make decisions and people who read papers, and it affects how interested they are in what is going on. So, I mean, to me, economics is at its best when you actually have people in the field talking to people, recording things that no one's recorded before, and painting pictures by numbers. And I think it's at its worst when it only exists on paper, and going back to that experience of going to university where no one seemed to have anything to say about what was going on at that very moment in time. And when I was a financial journalist, I found people used economic theory a bit like a religion. So, you know, the number of mortgage brokers who would say, oh, interest rates can only go up. That's the only thing that can happen. That's what the market says. And I think, wait a second, you're not really interrogating this. You're just, you've heard this jargon and you're going to embrace it, but you're not actually thinking through. So when I was, and I just want to talk to you a bit about how we did try and take some of the more interesting things that economists were doing in, you know, quiet ivory towers, I guess you could say, and bring it to the public. And when I was at the Mirror and the tax credits cuts were looming, which, by the way, tax credits is way more complicated than bonds or equities, I worked with the Resolution Foundation to find a way of telling people, our readers, who were going to be affected, what this meant. And what we came up with was there's no point going to work on a Friday. Basically, if you're a single mom and you've got one child and you get tax credits under the cuts, you earn no more for going to work on Friday, so why would you bother? So that kind of message, not only did it hit home, but we started to get readers coming in and writing to us and telling us about their situation, and we learned far more that way. So just to conclude, because I know I'm getting to the end of the time, I think the challenge for all of us is to be willing to learn from each other, for journalists to learn more from economists, make sure they understand the theory and the basic structures of the financial world, but also for economists to have conversations with people who write for the public every day and find ways to make the effort to make this story relevant to them. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rima. For those of you who don't know, I'll just tell you very briefly about the Barrow Cadbury Trust. We're a grant-making foundation based in London, but with a long-standing interest and relationship with Birmingham. And our mission is to use all of our assets, especially our money, to work with others to bring about structural change for a more just an equal society, which, you know, just feels like an impossible task over the last couple of days. We're nearly 100 years old. Our founders were Quakers, and their beliefs and vision for a more peaceful, just and equal society very much sit at the heart of the work that we do today, both in the causes that we support, but also in the way that we work with partners. And the Quaker imperative of speaking truth to power runs through all of our work. And so many of the projects that we support seek to amplify the voices of people that have so many challenges in their lives, be they young people in the criminal justice system, migrant communities, or people trying to manage a financial shock with very little savings. And the particular programme that I work on seeks to build fairer financial systems and reduce economic injustice. So easy. I'm just going to talk briefly about raising the quality of debate around economics and also the nature of the relationship of civil society organisations and others with government around economic issues. And this is, of course, much of part of a much bigger sort of model of change. Colleagues on the panel have talked about democratic representation, and I'm sure things like messaging and perhaps, you know, early education will come up in discussion later. But certainly, I mean, we at the Trust think to improve the quality of debate on economics, you know, as colleagues have said already, it's about getting as many people as possible to listen to the stories and to tell their stories and to understand what lies behind the headlines. And our approach has never been to target the broadsheets in the way that they report, but to seek to build the confidence of communities to share their stories and attach the importance to their own voice. So many of the grassroots projects that we support seek to address a problem by bringing people together. And it's not a new notion in any sense, but if you find people that share your issues and your concerns, maybe then you feel more confident, you feel angrier, you write to your local council, sign an online petition, go and stand outside of your local library when cuts are being made and you think it's going to close. The victory of two Uber drivers to be recognised as employed workers, ongoing campaigns by disability groups around cuts to their benefits, and the recent, you know, fantastic cases by the individuals that have challenged cuts to their housing benefit around bedroom tax, which has obviously been lost in the press in the last couple of days. All these are incredibly important examples of how people further from power have challenged authority and shared their stories. And perhaps not everybody listening to these stories understands them as a result of economic policy that promotes inequality, but we think that they will understand what it means to struggle on a tight budget or to work long hours for very little money. And most people have a view on fairness and can apply that to the stories that they hear, and particularly if they recognise themselves in those stories, might then question the truth behind another headline. Voluntary sector and campaigning organisations are essential in providing the infrastructure and practical support to help those people speak up, to capture those voices and to link them to local and national government. And where we can, we seek to build bridges between different institutions, communities and campaigners, academics and faith organisations, councils and the voluntary sector, and to amplify those and feed them into public and political debate. And just to give you one example of a sort of a new voice, which Rima and I heard recently, the Trust supported the University of Middlesex to do some research on SMEs paying the living wage, the real living wage, to their employees, to look at their reasons for doing it, how that fitted with their business model. And at the launch of that, in a room full of predominantly academics and voluntary sector representatives, we got to hear from a manager of a meatpacking business in the north of England talking incredibly passionately and eloquently about why their family-run organisation thought it was so important to pay the living wage to their employees. And, you know, that for me was a really unique story and an opportunity to hear that voice. And now it's the responsibility, I think, of the Trust and of the RSA and the University of Middlesex to push out the recommendations of that report to members of the business community. It's been our experience, unfortunately, that many voluntary sector and even campaigning organisations do now feel quite vulnerable about seeking to influence government around economic policy, and indeed most things, partly because of a reduced capacity for influencing, partly for fear of losing government funding, and also an increased sort of perception of scrutiny from regulators such as the Charity Commission. And so many of these organisations are seeking to change the way that perhaps they try and influence government by presenting evidence at select committees, going to APPGs, or building the voices of the people that they seek to represent to raise those issues themselves. And one example of that is Scope's Commission on Extra Costs, which some of you may be familiar with, which was looking at the extra costs individuals living with disabilities face on a daily basis. And the particular sort of tactic within that commission was to try and build the voice of individuals with disabilities as a consumer group to demand better. So to try and influence transport providers and energy providers and insurance companies and say, you know, we're a consumer group and you should serve our needs better. And there are other organisations like the National AIDS Trust and the Disability Rights Consortium who have taken a similar approach about building voice of users and movements and connecting these to governments around areas of economic policy. It's an obvious statement, but it's easy to ignore one voice. If you're a policymaker, it's much harder to ignore thousands of voices of individuals directly affected by an economic policy. Voluntary sector campaigning organisations also looking to influence economic policy at a local level. Some of you in the room might be familiar with Poverty Truth Commissions, very much part of the work that the Joseph Rowntree Foundation is doing at the moment. The idea of finding testifiers who are living with poverty in an area and then linking them with city leaders and local policymakers to talk about how their experiences are affected by service delivery. And we're currently working with the Poverty Truth Commission in Birmingham and think that that's an incredibly useful opportunity for individuals in positions of power, creative leadership, new opportunities from the devolution agenda to really hear about how the things that they're doing on a daily basis are affecting individuals and communities. And we think that the experiences of those testifiers in the Poverty Truth Commissions, like so many that will be shared over the course of the RSA's Citizens Economic Council, their experiences will be explained in words like debt and job loss, benefit sanctions, food banks, getting by, being broke. They're not going to be talked about in terms of GDP and inflation and job markets. And we hope that they will be heard and listened to by private business, by banks, civil society, local and national government and the public. And I think even if a shared language around economic policy is a long way off, it's incredibly important to build the understanding of the impact of that economic policy on communities and to transmit that up to people in positions of power. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And Jane.
Thank you, Rima. And thanks everyone for three really brilliant presentations. I'm a member of Rethinking Economics, and we're an international network of 45 student groups in 15 countries and about 300 active student organisers. And we campaign to demystify, diversify and reinvigorate economics, and we do that by supporting each other as a network and trying to grow our network to support each other to become a generation of socially engaged critical economists. And we campaign for curriculum reform in universities to make economics education more open and diverse and critical. And we also try to democratize economics by doing public education. We've set up an online magazine called Economy, which tries to do economics news for people who switch off the minute they hear the word economy. I'm going to focus on academic economics and what needs to change there. And I'm going to argue that we need a new relationship between experts and society. I'm going to look at the barriers within economics to do that, and then I'm going to talk about our vision as a movement for what economists should do and what economics could be. So I think there's a crisis of expertise and democracy, and I think three things a democracy should have. You know, citizens should be able to make an informed choice, they should have a voice, and they should be able to scrutinise the actions of their politicians and experts. And I think because of the state of economics today and debate and things we've heard about, that's generally not possible. So we would like to see a relationship in which experts aren't detached authority figures who work behind closed doors and give politicians the optimal policy. We would like to see experts who engage the public, who are more humble about the limits of their knowledge, are more open about their values and assumptions that go into their work, and ultimately give a range of options for citizens and politicians to discuss. And at the moment, I think economic discussion and policy making is a technical process. So we have some economic goals: increasing growth, low and stable inflation since 2008, financial stability, and the kind of general, the body of public discussion is about how to do those things, and it's a technical question. And that's a surefire recipe of switching people off. And we argue that it should be a social and political process, so it should be about discussions about what our economic goals and values are. And then once they are agreed, and experts play a role in that discussion, and then once they're agreed, experts play a role in working out how to do that. But that's the way it should go, and that's why the Citizens Economic Council is so welcome and so exciting. So the barriers within academic economics and economic policy making more generally, I think there are four. So one, I think economic experts haven't done enough to earn the trust of citizens. Well-publicised documentaries like The Inside Job, and then more academic research focusing particularly on America, but I think has tarnished the profession as a whole. Economic experts tend to inform the public of their research rather than engage them as equals. This is how the economy works. This is what you need to know. And there's an assumption there that if you know economics, you then will believe the same thing I believe. And that's a really important thing we need to get past. There's very little. So, for example, Freakonomics is a brilliant book, very well written and readable. But the analysis, there's no mention of the assumptions and methodology and values that go into that analysis, and it's presented as scientific. And we would like, the way to make Freakonomics better would be to improve those things. They too rarely acknowledge the limits of their expertise. And most importantly, I think, is that the discipline as a whole is too unrepresentative of society. So only one in four academic economists are women, and the ratio is similar for students. A 2010 Royal Economic Society survey found that 82% of respondents were white. After that, they stopped counting. And of 75 Nobel Prize winners, only two in economics weren't white, and one was a woman. So these are the barriers. We kind of, in the book we've written, we've set out a vision of something that's explicitly public interest economist. And this requires a major shift in the discipline of economics, and it requires a major shift in our universities in their mission and what they do. And we believe, honestly, that academic economics can be a bridge to a wider renewal of society and democracy, but at the moment it's a barrier. So public interest economics or economists would do four things. They'd hold the powerful to account, or try, and they'd draw on classic liberal political theory, and they would maybe draw on good examples in journalism, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. They would take seriously the challenges of creating participatory economic institutions, citizens' economic councils, citizens' committee in the Bank of England, participatory budgeting, you know, take your pick. And it would involve experiments to start with, but if economists as a profession took that seriously, how exciting would it be? They would also take seriously the challenges of communicating economics, and in that they could maybe learn from the science communication movement. And finally, they would take seriously the challenge of creating a new generation of citizen economists. Universities maybe acting as hubs for the local community, taking responsibility and opening up their doors and having workshops and courses for adults and for young people. Students engaging citizens as part of their education, doing projects with local community groups. There is, I think, some recognition among the profession after Brexit that they need to do better at lots of these things. I think at the moment, though, there is still a tendency to think we need to communicate what we know better and then people will make the right decision. And I think that's part of the problem, not the solution. It needs to be much more two-way. It needs to be much more of a dialogue and not a lecture. Economists need to recognise that they need to learn as much from citizens as citizens need to learn from them. I think that's it. I think that's where we're at. And hopefully over the next few years and all together, we can get a few steps further along the line.
So I think there's some really fantastic suggestions for change, not least, you know, the need to look at wider political structures and the way we do democracy, improving the quality of discussion about democracy and the role of deliberative democracy and being able to do that, bringing citizens together with economists and experts in order to do that. The very strong theme emerging here about recognising that economics as a discipline is very much pluralist. There are a host of moral and political assumptions embedded in economics, and being explicit up front and transparent about that is absolutely essential if we're going to talk in a way that builds trust in economics as a discipline. The really, really important point about story and making sure that people's experiences of the economy are heard, and indeed that is part of the work that we're doing through our Economic Inclusion Roadshow. We've been in places like Port Talbot, where we've spoken to steelworkers affected by deindustrialisation in Oldham, where we've had conversations about decline of mills, for example, and the impact on the economy there, and that's running until the Economic Council starts its deliberations in January. And of course, a really critical point about the quality of discussion and debate in the media, and ensuring that the media is also reflecting the pluralism and the plurality of voices about economics. So thank you very, very much. We're now going to start some cross-panel discussion, and I just had a question, really, and I wanted to engage with, as it were, the elephant in the room, which is the election result that we're all probably reeling from. If you're not, then okay, but I certainly am reeling from it. It's really a quote from Bernie Sanders, which I just want to ask our panellists to engage with. And he had this to say: Donald Trump tapped into the anger of a declining middle class that is sick and tired of establishment economics, establishment politics, and the establishment media. To what extent do our panellists think this statement is justified, and does it apply in the UK as well? Katie?
Sure. It's part of the truth. I think one of the kind of challenges now, isn't it, that we're particularly in Britain, we're sort of looking at Brexit, we're looking at the election, we're probably trying to make sense of it and tell a very simple story. I think it's actually more complex than that. But is the basis of what he said right, in that people were sick of what they called what to them was the establishment and felt let down by that, then absolutely that's right. But I think it's really important to dig deeper into the demographics, who voted for the different candidates in America. You know, these things are not completely clear cut, and it's certainly not the case, for example, that one candidate swept up all the votes of the people who had the least income, even if we know that. So I just think it's really important. So yes, I'd agree with part of that. And as I think I suggested earlier, I think there is something about, and this happened with our referendum here, and it's a political point as well about the voting system. In the referendum, every single person's vote counted. It was not a postcode lottery. So your voice was heard and your vote was counted up, and that ultimately led to a Leave decision. That is not the case under the first past the post electoral system, where unless you live in a competitive seat, your voice will not be heard, your vote will not be weighted in the same way. So there's a very strong relationship now between our political system, first past the post, and we're going to be doing some research to look at whether areas actually get more investment if they're a marginal political seat over the safe areas of the country, which our theory is we think that they may be neglected. So I think, yes, it's part of the story, certainly, but not the whole of it.
Thank you. Yeah, I would agree. I was looking at the exit polls yesterday, and actually the poorest section of society voted for Hillary. So it is, from what I understand, quite a specific demographic of people who feel left behind, particularly older working class men in perhaps deindustrialised towns, which is definitely one group of people who may feel left behind, but there are others. So I won't delve too much into analysing the election. I think in the UK, again, people who voted for Brexit seem to fit quite a similar demographic, but again, are not always the poorest people in society or the ones that need the most help. And I'd certainly argue are not the ones who are going to benefit from Brexit. I mean, you know, the people in the north of England who have been in safe Labour seats have not really had a chance to use their vote or express what is happening to their communities. Sadly, it looks like they might be the ones who are also most affected by the negotiations, because if there's any kind of downturn, it's going to affect the poorest first.
I certainly think that there's a feeling in this country within the middle class and you know within the states as well that there's a belt tightening that's occurring that perhaps isn't being voiced or recognised by many politicians, and certainly the language used by Donald Trump is grotesque to us, but it's accessible to many of those Americans who do just really care about, you know, paying their bills and having a job. And, you know, he was able to tap into that. And I do think there's a lot about the way that politicians are speaking and just not capturing the views, of people that feel that they're contributing and not being represented.
Thank you.
I don't know. I'm very much trying to, in processing mode. I think... I guess just to bring it back to onto a personal level, and having been in school in the last 15 years, and I think there having the feeling from kind of setting in classes in the way that my school, which was quite mixed, and where people have ended up, I do feel that there is, in the sense, there are kinds of divides in our society here. That by the time you are 18, there are some people who feel confident talking about economics and feel like they have a voice and that their voice is heard, and then there are some people who don't feel confident and who don't feel that their voice is heard. And how there's definitely a correlation there between whether you have that feeling or not and your material and economic circumstances. I think there are other things going on too, as has been mentioned, but yeah, there's definitely, I think, much deeper splits in our society than maybe we would have liked to have thought, and I think those splits take place and are already there by the time people are 16, even earlier, but you know, by the time they leave school.
Can I add to that? Another thing is actually the intergenerational inequality, and I mean this is something that I fear a bit with the analysis of Brexit and the analysis of the Trump election misses out, that actually one of the biggest generations to be left behind is the generation that's coming up, but they haven't necessarily quite realised it yet. So rather than always talking about people in coastal towns who feel left behind, I'd like a bit more conversation about these people as well.
just to jump in there, that it was the it was younger people in America who cast their vote, much more likely to cast their vote for a third party, which I think is really significant as well. So they were the people who were like, I'm not going to go for either of these two. I'm going to cast a vote, even if it's meaningless for somebody else as well. So again, the kind of the politics and the economics point there.
Thank you. Another question. Something that really has emerged as a bit of a pattern is the decline of trust in experts. And obviously we've alluded to that and we've mentioned that. Why don't we trust experts anymore? And what can we do about this?
Well, I mean, there's a lot more. We're a flatter, more less deferential society, aren't we? Some of these changes have been happening. Social changes have been happening for a number of times. So I think it's not that surprising anymore. And also, there's a lot more information and knowledge that in theory, at least, we can draw to us and digest and so on. And we have citizen journalists. And, you know, we're in a kind of different world now. So I think it's not that surprising, therefore, that you can have a referendum and people won't do what they were used to do more frequently, which was just take your cue from the party leader and think, well, I don't know much about this, which often happens in referendums. I'll take my cue, or, oh, the IMF said that, I'll just go along with it. I think for all kinds of social reasons, for good or ill, we don't do that now. I think expertise come from a number of different sources. I think what's dangerous, can be dangerous about that, is then going completely the other way and dismissing the IMF. So instead of having a rich conversation where you've got citizens' expertise, you've got, you know, people running businesses and companies, you've got the IMF or some other body, a traditional expert body, all in the mix, you know, and I really love sort of Joe's model. Instead of getting that, you're getting this kind of dismissal of expertise. So again, I think it's really complicated, but I'm not surprised that the kind of old style, oh look, there's an expert and we're just going to take an opinion from them without qualification or a chance to digest it. I'm not really surprised that that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think I benefited from expertise because when I was a financial journalist, I didn't study economics, I studied history, and I started and I thought, I do not have a clue what I'm doing. And very luckily, there were a lot of financial firms that actually give training courses to journalists. So I spent quite a lot of time learning what bonds were, learning what equities were. And having moved into politics, I keep hearing references that I'm like, wait, but that doesn't make technical sense. And I do think that there is, I think our financial markets are fascinating because they are created out of our imagination to a certain extent and rules that we've drawn up. And you do have to kind of learn them, just as if you're a fan of football, you learn a lot of rules along the way. But I think they're unnecessarily clouded by jargon. There could be a lot more outreach of teaching people about these things, because otherwise, you know, if you just hear someone telling you take the most controversial in the coming up to the Brexit vote was forecasts, and if you're just told, well, we say that it's going to cost us all this much, and no, you can't see the working because it's very complicated, of course people are going to react in a negative way.
I'd agree with that, and I think there's something around experts and the perception of privilege that they come with. They don't look like you and me, they don't speak like you and me, the jargon that's used. I was really fascinated by my my uncle, who voted to leave in the referendum vote, and the thing that he'd sort of drawn from, you know, he'd obviously seen some experts say this somewhere or other, was the salary of MEPs, and this is the thing that he'd sort of regurgitated over and over again. That was his reason for voting out, and that, you know, it's the idea of this soundbite that really appealed to him, and he didn't feel the need to interrogate around the edges of that, and you know, this sort of skill now that the experts have in producing those pieces of information that people will tack onto, and you know, some people will absorb that in different ways. But yes, certainly I think if you have different groups of people that are contradicting each other in front of you and you can't relate to either of them, then, you know, why would you trust and sort of look behind the scenes at what they're saying?
I would agree with all of that, and I would just maybe add something about the way that politics has changed. And so Thomas Frank, who's an American political commentator and kind of in a sense predicted Trump winning, talks about the well-graduated and the Democratic Party becoming the party of the well-graduated, in the sense that expertise is never neutral and out there. It's always connected to power and politics, and maybe people recognise that in many ways, kind of economics is closely connected, and maybe there's an element of that's a source of distrust too, if that makes sense.
Great, and now there's a chance and an opportunity for you to ask questions. Great.
Thank you. Jeremy Kaplan, I'm a fellow of the Royal Society. Two things. You asked about the experts. Why don't people trust them? Because they get it wrong, and they are not accountable for getting it wrong. Nobody saw 2008. There were a lot of people, trust me, I'm an expert. House prices will go up forever and ever and ever. And so on and so forth. Paddy Ashdown was brought onto a panel before an election and said, if that happens, I'll eat my hat. Well, they didn't try to make him eat a hat, but they still call him in and ask him for his expert opinion. So there is an accountability issue that how often do they actually ever have to get judged on how accurate their predictions were, and have almost like a scorecard like surgeons might have to do on deaths on their table. So that's one point. The other point is Ken Livingstone wrote a very interesting book 20 years ago, and the title was, If Voting Changed Anything, They'd Abolish It. And I think we were getting very close, particularly the lady from the Electoral Reformist Society, where people were just in a groove of going through the motions of nothing is going to change. I can vote for Conservatives or Labour, I can vote for Republicans or Democrats, but actually nothing's going to change. Brexit and Donald Trump were giving people a chance to vote on something very, very different. It was actually a liberation for people to say, you know what, I've got a very strong point of view on this and I'm going to vote on it. So I think that's what I'd like a little bit more debate on.
And did you have a particular question for the panel?
Well, it comes back to why aren't experts accountable, number one. And number two, isn't the issue that democracy has become apathy? And unless you give people to vote on things that are really critical when the pain's really being felt, you're actually not going to get a response. It's a very blunt instrument.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say I'm a little surprised that we've had a fairly long discussion about economics and the public and people, and nobody has mentioned two areas which are very related. One is pensions, which I see as the next big crisis, and the second is related, money making money, and the industry that's involved in that and how much we are dominated by that.
One of the features of the Trump campaign, and certainly the referendum, was a total disrespect for evidence and facts. As a simple example, Dussmann and Frattini produced a report about 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, showing that it was a significant net benefit from immigration fiscally. And that just gets rubbished. I mean, I heard Douglas Carswell rubbishing it on Any Questions. He commented on the moral integrity of the authors. Who was paying them was the question. So how do we get respect for facts? We've just lived through two campaigns with a torrent of lies and bullshit. Do you have any ideas how we can actually get people to do policy, evidence-based policy, and not the other way around?
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll be really brief because I know we're short on time. We've published a report called It's Good to Talk, looking at the referendum experience. So there's lots of ideas in there about the kind of this advent of sort of post-truth politics and the complete absence of facts, and I agree with you on that. In very simple terms, we absolutely have to build up people's capacity to take on board the knowledge, to digest, to deliberate, to do all of that so that they are better armed and they're not just put in a position where they're being broadcast at and it's all about emotion and the fact just dissipates. So I think that's what I'd say to that one. I can shorten time. Do you want me to leave other questions to others and leave it there?
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I'll pick up on the pensions first, seeing as I think that's a great example of something that is very hard to get young people to be interested in when you're a journalist writing about it. And yet, when you get to a certain age, your readers get to a certain age and they suddenly have a pension, they care so much about it. And I think it goes down to, does it relate to you? But because it's something that you really do need to plan ahead for, it's encouraging people to think about the future. And the way that we used to do it is, you know, will you be able to retire? Will you be able to spend your later life sitting on a beach or not? In terms of the next big crisis, I mean, I think the fact that, yes, we're seeing it now with, the closed store that BHS. I guess really we should have had the collective imagination to be writing about that some time ago, but you know, I know that journalists didn't, and it seems that other policymakers and politicians didn't really think about it either, because we've known that there's been black holes in pension schemes for some time. Obviously, Philip Green has not made that any better, but we know that there are other schemes out there that could also be affected. Just very quickly on the facts and the expertise, I completely agree. I think the 2008 financial crisis, we're still seeing the repercussions of that, and I think that has chipped away quite dramatically at trust for economists in particular. I also think that I did a piece where I took every prediction and forecast about Brexit and I put where the funding for each think tank or economist came from. So I said, and you know what, the least trustworthy was the Economist for Brexit one, because it was like six guys in a room. Everyone else was a big organisation. At the bottom, in the comment section, people still said, it's all lies. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think that at least trying to explain where things are coming from is a start.
Thank you. I just draw people's attention to Full Fact. I don't know if anyone's familiar with them, but they're an independent fact-checking charity that seeks to fact check statements by MPs and the media, and they've done question time and things like that, live debates. I mean, what they're seeking to do is incredibly important. Obviously the issues are, how do you get people to, you know, read the third page of The Sun about something which has been reported in the wrong way, or to sign up for their newsletter and explain to you a statement that you've heard by an MP and what's behind it all. But certainly I think there are organisations like that, you know, seeking to get the facts out there. And yes, you know, accountability of experts, they all come with some kind of an agenda, and we know that, and maybe we need to sort of seek to build a message around, it's all right to give your, you know, your view, but then say at the end, this isn't the definitive, I don't know. You know, that's the responsible thing to do, but there seems to be this, particularly, I think, in the media, when you sort of see the interviews, that there is a pressure for a kind of a final point, a final answer and a soundbite, which people can digest, and maybe we just need to, you know, support a sort of a more open discourse, and this idea that, you know, nobody, these are all suppositions and suggestions, but that there are unknowns out there.
I agree absolutely that we need to find paths to a kind of more kind of evidence-based, a more critical public discourse. I guess I think there's a real worry about the kind of narrative which is like, we need to get people to accept the facts, because that very quickly turns into certain people saying, oh, if you support that view, you're kind of ignorant and uneducated, and that kind of widens the divide. And I do think there's a very real kind of case for looking at our economic statistics, our facts, and saying, you know, if GDP growth is caused by growth in financial service activity, is that having any knock-on effects in terms of people's, you know, real lived experience? And if it's not, maybe they're right. Maybe ignoring that fact is the right thing to do. And so looking at ourselves as well in that journey towards finding a way to have better quality public debate. And then, yeah, of course, we missed out the elephant in the room. They get it wrong all the time. And they're not accountable. And I think the way to address that is through things like the Citizens Council. It's through finding ways. The problem is they're wrong. And yet when we're in a crisis, we're driven straight back into the arms of experts to get us out of it. And so to find ways to hold experts more accountable and to have their expertise fed in a way that's less like they're the authoritative figure and they're more the humble advisor. Yeah, I think that's the only way, and it's going to take a long time and lots of hard work.
Thank you. That's a great note for us to wrap up on. The best way to address some of these challenges through the Citizens Economic Council. Brilliant. And you know, sadly, I think that's all we've got time for. And I really want to thank the audience in the room and online for such a fantastic conversation. I want to say thank you to the fantastic RSA events team and the Citizens Economic Council programme team who have done so much hard work on there. Thank you to our partners, the Barry Cadbury Trust and Friends of Providence Foundation, as well as Trust for London. And most of all, could we please have a round of applause, finally, for our panellists? Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.